The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Coming up, Debbie and I are going to do our Friday roundup. We're going to talk about the Fannie Willis disqualification decision. We're going to talk about the proposed TikTok ban. Also, I'll reveal how U.S. involvement in Ukraine has, from the outset, been based on illusions and lies, raising the question, what are we doing there at all? Hey, if you're watching on Rumble or listening on Apple, Google, or Spotify, please subscribe to my channel. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Show.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Some interesting developments in the Fannie Willis case. The judge, McAfee, has just issued his ruling. And what he does is, well, I suppose to some degree he splits the baby, or he has a divided ruling in judicial language or legal language. He goes, the motion to disqualify is denied in part and affirmed in part. So what does the judge here say? Well, he generally resolves the factual issues kind of in favor of Fannie Willis by saying, in effect, what she did is not demonstrably wrong, but it gives the impression of being wrong. What he says is that they haven't proven that she had a conflict of interest. They haven't proven that she took money. They haven't proven that she had a relationship prior to appointing this guy. So there's a little bit of ambiguity here. And I've talked about this in my previous discussions of what the evidence showed. And the judge sort of resolves this ambiguity by giving Fannie Willis the benefit of the doubt. He says her behavior is improper. No, she shouldn't have appointed Wade in this way. She never disclosed it. She kept paying him large sums of money. He implies that this is kind of unethical. He goes on to say she shouldn't have gone in that church and basically launched a tirade where she discusses the case. That was, again, not grounds enough for disqualification, but kind of improper. And so after a lot of hemming and hawing, the judge concludes, all right. He says, even though we have not established a conflict of interest, there is an appearance. There's enough smoke here that casts doubt on whether this is being carried out in a sort of proper or kosher manner. And so he says, one of two things has to happen. Either Fannie Willis and her office needs to get out of the case, or Nathan Wade needs to get out of the case. And I think what we know what that means. What it means is that Nathan Wade will get out of the case and Fannie Willis will continue to be able to push forward with the case. Now, it's possible this will produce some delays, but and I've seen conflicting accounts about sort of who this is a victory for. Megyn Kelly in her post this morning basically says, well, this is actually pretty good for the defense because it does put, it takes a prosecution that was moving in tandem, Fannie Willis, Nathan Wade, this whole team, the setting dates, doing discovery, making plea deals, and now with the chief prosecutor having to exit the scene, there's going to have to be, at the very least, a regrouping, not to mention the fact that the defense can constantly raise issues of conflict of interest. They can appeal, I believe, this judge's ruling, which would mean it would now go to an appellate court. They can continue to maintain that they are not getting justice. And so they can also argue, by the way, that some of the some of the things that Fannie Willis is accusing them of, she herself did. So making false statements, for example, to the court. And so I don't think this is over, but I do think that the judge here took the safe road. And that is, by the way, he's facing re-election. Debbie and I will talk a little bit about this when we have our powwow coming up shortly. I also want to talk to Debbie about the TikTok ban. The TikTok ban that was passed by the House hasn't been passed yet by the Senate, but given the fact that it had pretty strong bipartisan support in the House, I think it's quite likely that this will in fact go through. And so we will talk about the implications. I want to offer some comments in this opening segment about Ukraine, because there's an effort now to renew Ukraine funding, to pressure Mike Johnson into having a Ukraine vote. And what Mike Johnson seems to be saying is, all right, if we do a Ukraine vote, I'm not going to tie it to Israel. I'm not going to tie it to the border. I'm not going to make it some package where we are voting on a bunch of different things that are all separate from each other. If you want to have a Ukraine vote, we will put the proposal by itself, put it before the House. And so Johnson appears inclined to have a vote on Ukraine. And the problem with this whole Ukraine business is that the discussion of it is generally conducted in extremely broad terms. Are you for Ukraine or are you not? Do you want to help Putin or do you not? Do you believe that Putin will stop with Ukraine or do you not? And all of this, what it misses, what it ignores, is that from the beginning of this war, we were told by the government and other Western governments the same, that there are really strong economic and military and diplomatic and humanitarian benefits that would come out of supporting Ukraine. Let's visit those in turn. Economic benefits. Well, the idea is that the sanctions would crush the Russian economy. The Russians would feel the pain. It might even result in an overthrow of Putin. But it turns out that this is not the case. We've had sanctions. The Russians have felt some burden. But as Tucker Carlson found out when he was walking around Moscow, it's not like they're missing. They have designer shops. They have all kinds of grocery stores. And the grocery stores have all sorts of fruits and vegetables and meat and provisions. So the Russians are operating pretty normally despite sanctions. And yet, who has been hurt? Well, the European governments, and they've been hurt partly because countries like Germany had the benefit of buying cheap Russian oil. Suddenly they can't do that because of sanctions. And so this is destabilizing governments in Europe. So the economic benefit, not really. The harm seems to be falling more on us than on them. Military. The Biden administration told us that we can weaken Russia military, we can deplete its arsenal. The Russians are not going to be able to have any capacity to wage this kind of war again. But it turns out the Russians have responded in the opposite way. Number one, they have amped up their war production. More artillery shells, more tanks, more drones, more weaponry of war. Number two, the Russians have greatly boosted their enlistments. They're like, we're at war, let's sign up. So all these Russians have now signed up. And not only do we have a larger Russian army, but the Russian army is now battle tested because they've been fighting in Ukraine. They are battle hardened in the sense that that Western governments are not. And while all this is going on, NATO and the West has had to amp up its production and stockpiles, when those stockpiles are now being depleted. Let's turn now to the sort of diplomatic and geopolitical side, where, again, the Biden administration told us that it'll be really wonderful to see all these different Western countries come together. This will demonstrate Western unity and Western resolve. But as it turns out, a lot of countries are not on board with this Ukraine war. Some of them give it lip service, but they don't really support it. Certainly the BRICS countries, the so-called are working on building an alternative currency. This is countries like South Africa and Brazil, and of course Russia and China. And it seems that Russia is making new friends among people who are not on board with this whole Western approach to Ukraine. Putin visited recently the UAE and Saudi Arabia. He was greeted as a sort of welcoming hero. Let's remember, Saudi Arabia has been a pretty close U.S. ally now for decades. BRICS has added 5 new members. It's got a long waiting list of people who want to join. And there are countries that are in the U.S. alliance that are also beginning to worry and saying, in effect, listen, you know, we don't want the U.S. to be able to drop sanctions on us just because we take a position that the U.S. doesn't like. So we're not comfortable with giving the United States this kind of global power. We think that there needs to be some countervailing or counterbalancing forces against U.S. influence. And finally, the humanitarian argument, where we were told that, look, we got to help the Ukrainian people. They're at the mercy of the Russians. We need to alleviate their suffering. But what happens when a war drags on is more Ukrainians get killed. There's actually more suffering. You have a depletion of a whole generation of young Ukrainians who get killed off in the war. There are a ton of Ukrainians who are fleeing. They've left the country. And so you have the possibility or the likelihood of a sort of demographic collapse. And a demographic collapse doesn't mean the population vanishes. The Ukrainian people are still there. But the ingredients that make for a healthy society to be able to perpetuate itself, to have, you know, children and grandchildren and move into the future, all of this is gravely imperiled. And it becomes more imperiled the more the war drags on. So what this means is that at the very least, the stated objectives of us getting involved in Ukraine not only have not been realized, but it doesn't seem like we're moving any closer to realizing them. And for these reasons, I think we need to think very carefully about whether we want to prolong the war and send even more money, money we can ill afford to send, over to Zelensky and over to Ukraine. Financial experts thought we were in the clear. They were anticipating around 6 rate cuts by the Fed this year. And then the inflation data came out higher than expected. So friends, this isn't going away. It can't. The U.S. is $34 trillion in the hole. And yet we keep printing money, which pushes the prices you pay every day even higher. So you can either bury your head in the sand or you can do something about it. What to do? Well, diversify a portion of your savings into gold with Birch Gold Group. Gold is your hedge against inflation, and Birch Gold makes it easy to own. They'll help you to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and you don't pay a penny out of pocket. Gold is part of our savings strategy. Debbie and I buy it from Birch Gold. You can too. Text Dinesh to 989898. Get your free information kit on gold. Then talk to a precious metal specialist on how to protect your savings from persistent inflation with gold. Text Dinesh to 989898. No time to waste. Do it now. How are you feeling these days? I feel great. One of the reasons I feel so good is because of this. I take Balance of Nature fruits and veggies in a capsule. So easy to take. They have an amazing story of how this product was developed by Dr. Douglas Howard. It's right there on their website, balanceofnature.com. Now, Balance of Nature receives over 1,000 success stories every single month. They have hundreds of thousands of customers who have purchased billions of capsules of their fruits and veggies over the past 20 years. Their products are gluten-free. They're non-GMO. They contain no added sugars or synthetics. So I think if you're looking for something to make you feel better naturally, you should definitely give Balance of Nature a try. In fact, order today. When you order online or call their direct number, you got to use the promo code America and you'll get 35% off plus $10 off any additional sets plus free shipping and a money-back guarantee. So here's the number to call, 800-246-8751. Again, 800-246-8751, or you can go to balanceofnature.com. When you use discount code America, you get 35% off, plus $10 off additional sets, plus free shipping and a money-back guarantee. Debbie and I are here for the Friday roundup, and we were talking on the way to the podcast about this just-out decision on Fannie Willis, and you were saying that, from your point of view, it's bad news. In other words, this is not going to restore our confidence in the judicial system at all. And did you kind of expect that the judge would fold in this way and try to split the baby?
Well, I really thought we're dealing with a very corrupt DA's office. And I think alongside that, right, you're going to have corrupt judges. So how do we know that this judge isn't as corrupt as she is? How do we know that it's going to be a fair trial no matter what, regardless of whether or not she had done this or not? You know, the fact of the matter is the judge has said, well, either you do it or Wade does it, right? So
one of you has to exit.
Well, so what? How is that going to change the outcome? It's not. And you said, yeah, but the jury's going to like know how corrupt she is. No, they're not. No, they're not. Why do you think that she's so confident that she can try Trump in Fulton County and get a conviction?
You're saying, what you're really saying is that two things. One is that Fulton County is a cesspool. And second, it is a little bit like Washington, D.C. It's got left-wing prosecutors. Well, we know that this is a judge. You know, he and his wife both made small contributions to Fannie Willis. So we know that they're ideologically somewhat on the same page. Now there's also the other factor, which is that the judge now has a political opponent who's running against him, who's from the left. And so the judge is probably thinking, well, listen, how do I fend off this guy from the left? Maybe if I give a decision that keeps Fannie Willis in place, I'll be able to be more successful in my campaign for re-election. So you have all these factors. And finally, you're saying, well, I think the numbers in Fulton County are something like 73% Democrat, which
there
is a pretty big number.
So that means 73% of the jury pool will be Democrat. If you think about
right.
it.
Not as bad as D.C., where it's like 95%.
Yeah, but it's still the majority, right?
It's still the majority.
And again, there's a chance that there's a hung jury, yes, but there's also a chance there's not.
Right. Well, often happens, as you know, in these jury systems is that the holdouts get browbeaten by the other jurors.
Exactly.
And sometimes what they say, they almost like bargain out the conviction, right? They go, okay, well, listen, instead of finding him guilty on all these seven charges, let's just find him guilty on two of the charges, mm-hmm. and then you guys agree to go along with that. So what you're getting here is, I think, you know, we have a civics book idea of how justice operates, and what we're seeing is that there is a lot of self-interest involved. There's a lot of how do I stay in office?
And
there's
corruption.
A lot of how do I get my political opponents? And just outright corruption.
Yeah,
and all
corruption.
Of this plays
and
in.
So how do you have confidence in a jury system in Fulton County that where justice is not blind? I mean, the folds are completely off. So
right.
it's just horrible. It's so sad that we have come to a place in this country where the outcome of a conviction is predictable. And predictable in not a good way.
Based on the political complexion.
That's
of
right.
See, I think what's very troubling about all this is it puts into question our confidence in our Republican structure of government itself. And here's why. Because if you say that the majority can run roughshod on people's rights, right? And the founders were worried about that tyranny of the majority.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, well, okay, but we've got some counterbalancing forces. Well, what are those? The judicial system is an important one because the judicial system is supposed to be impartial. And it doesn't matter if 98% of people want to take away your First Amendment right, they shouldn't be able to. It doesn't matter if the majority of people want to lock you up because they don't agree with your politics, they shouldn't be able to. But what we're seeing now is that they can.
That's because the Democratic Party runs on the mantra of tyranny of the majority. That's their mantra, actually.
Right. And since they don't have a majority in the country as a whole,
it's wherever they can get it.
They can find local majorities, right? Washington, D.C. is a Democratic majority. So they use their pockets of power.
That's right.
To run roughshod over people's rights. And you're saying that's what's going on in this case.
That's why if you look around the country, even in South Texas, where I'm very familiar with the politics down there, it's corrupt. The system of justice down in the valley is corrupt. Why? Because it's run by Democrats and they're all corrupt and they all run this whole like, hey, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. So this is how they operate everywhere that they lead, everywhere that they have a majority. They bank on it.
I mean, I think one thing that's funny is every time you're in the valley, or often even just talking to people, they'll say to you, well, you know, it's all based upon the candidate. It's all based upon, you know, it's all based upon the person. Debbie, we should vote for the person and not the party. And I think the point you make is that, no, it is the party. And the Democratic Party, yes, it might have taken on a somewhat different complexion, whether it's JFK's party or Truman's party, or whether it's the Clintons or whether it's Obama. Not that these people are identical or interchangeable, but there is a root corruption that we see consistently. It may manifest itself differently. With the Clintons, it's selling pardons, and with Obama, it's something else. And with the Clintons, it's setting up an international foundation, and with the Bidens, it's a family racket. But it's a racket nonetheless.
It's a racket.
And there was a racket going back to FDR. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about the way in which the media covered for all the disgusting behavior of JFK. And this was a media that was a lot less ideologically left-wing than the media today. But nevertheless, they were in JFK's camp, and they were like, you do whatever you want, we're going to look the other way. We're just not going to. So the censorship of the Hunter Biden laptop has its precedence in the media coverage covering up of all the scandals of JFK. And I'm not just talking, by the way, about his sexual scandals. I mean, there were mafia connections. And I mean, the Kennedy family was a bootlegging operation. That's how they made their money. So they were running afoul of the law, all kinds of stuff that was just made subordinate to the myth of Camelot.
Yeah, well, as Trump so famously said, everything the Democrats do turns to feces. And it's true. I mean, just take a look at the Rio Grande Valley. I just came back, you know, to see my mom again. And every time I go down there, I'm like, yeah, this is feces. All right. I'm sorry. I hate to say it because I lived there for a very long time. I grew up there, but it's obvious. It's very evident when you step into that zone that and really, if you go to any major city that's run by Democrats, you see it and you smell it.
They've created a patronage operation.
And, that's right.
And they hire their friends. I mean, look at Fannie Willis. She hires Nathan Wade. And it's interesting that apparently no red flags were raised about this in the office. She's able to get away with it. It's only because this Mike Roman guy blew the whistle on it that it even came before the judge at all. I think the judge felt obligated to do something. What he did, of course, falls far short of enough. But it allows him to assuage his conscience and go, well, listen, I took some steps to, you know, to limit the appearance of impropriety, even though I think he fell woefully short. Mike Lindell has a passion to help you get the best sleep of your life. After he invented the world's best pillow, he created the famous Giza Dream Sheets. Debbie and I love them. We have them all over the house. They're the best sheets you will ever sleep on. For a limited time, you get a queen size set for $59.98, king size just $69.98. the lowest prices in history. Mike and the MyPillow gang continue to be canceled by the big box stores. They're attacked by the media. So they really appreciate all of your great support during these times and want to thank you by giving you free shipping on your entire order today. To get the specials, go to MyPillow.com or you can call 800-876-0227. Use promo code Dinesh. You get the famous Giza Dream Sheets. Queen size $59.98, king size just $69.98. By the way, 60% off the original My Slipper. So go ahead and call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com. Don't forget to use the promo code, which is D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh, for free shipping today. Guys, if you'd like to support my work, I invite you to check out my Locals channel and consider becoming a monthly or an annual subscriber. I post a lot of exclusive content on Locals, including content that's censored on other social media platforms. On Locals, you get Dinesh Unchained, Dinesh Uncensored. You can also interact with me directly. I do a live weekly Q&A every Tuesday. 8 p.m. Eastern, no topic is off limits. I've also uploaded some cool films to Locals, documentaries, feature films. 2,000 Mules is up there, and so is the latest film, Police State. And of course, if you are an annual subscriber, you can stream and watch these movies and this content for free. It's included with your subscription. So check out the channel. It's dinesh.locals.com. I'd love to have you along for this great ride. Again, it's dinesh.locals.com. The House of Representatives, by a pretty decisive vote, bipartisan, a vote to, well, I wouldn't say ban TikTok. It demands that TikTok be shut down in the United States or be sold to a U.S. Owner or to a consortium that is not beholden to a U.S. adversary. Now, what do you make of this TikTok business?
Well, I think that it's already clear that the Gen Zers are going to vote Democrat. But let me just say that if you take away TikTok, it will be a guarantee that they'll vote Democrat.
Well, let's remember that especially, the people taking it away, though, are not Republicans.
Okay,
they're not exclusively Republicans.
Okay,
this is not a Republican bill.
So this is a bipartisan bill. Okay, well, then
it's cutting in a very funny way. Nancy Pelosi, for example, is for the TikTok ban. AOC is against it.
Okay.
A lot of the Marco Rubio Republicans, Dan Crenshaw, are for the TikTok ban. Trump is against it.
Yeah, yeah.
The libertarians, of course, like Rand Paul, are totally against it.
Right.
So you've got these cross-cutting coalitions. Let's frame the issue a little bit. The people who are in favor of the TikTok ban say this. They say, listen, we're not restricting free speech. We're not even discussing the content of what is on any platform. We're simply asking this question. Who owns the platform? Who directs it? Who controls it? If it is an adversary to the United States, we can fairly assume that they will use this as a weapon of ideological propaganda. And therefore, we don't want a Chinese consortium that is answerable to the CCP, that is turning over data to the CCP, and that's what this bill outlaws. Now, that's the one side of it, but here's the other side of it. When you read the language, it's a little vague. Who gets to decide if somebody's an adversary? The president. Biden. Who gets to decide whether a foreign entity is directing or controlling a platform? The president. Biden. So let's say, for example, let's take an extreme example that Biden decides, I think Trump is a Russian asset. Therefore, Truth Social, which is a Trump platform, is controlled by a foreign adversary. Therefore, before the election, it should be banned. Now, that may be a little bit of a facile reading, but we know that Democrats, when you create an opening, so this is my view. If I was, you know, if we can roll the clock back to the Reagan era, I would most likely have been in favor of this. But today, I'm against it.
Yeah.
Why? Because I have little to zero trust in our own government's ability to take something like this and confine it to the limits of the intention.
Yeah, I mean, look at the Patriot Act, and to go further, even just I was at the airport yesterday, and there's a lady that had formula and water, and there's this big discussion on whether or not to let her go through the flight because of all this liquid that she had. And I was thinking to myself, Does she look like a terrorist? I mean, really? What have we become? I think about it and I'm like, 30 minutes south of here, people are just hoarding in to the United States. You know, no taking your shoes off, no knowing where you come from. You might be a criminal, you might be a terrorist, you're coming right in. And then they're so careful about not letting her take the formula or take the water. You know, it's like,
and by the way, the illegals board airplanes without ID.
Oh, yes.
They don't even need an ID.
Yes. I was on a plane.
They just fill out a form that says you don't need an ID. I mean, so this is what we're getting at. We're saying when laws are applied so in such a kind of inconsistent manner, it's sort of like, we like these people, so we're just going to put them above the law.
Yeah, yeah.
And on the other hand, we're going to maintain with rigorous consistency that, you know, this mom is trying to carry formula, but it's liquid, so that runs afoul of the rules. Mm-hmm. So the rules are applied with great fastidiousness over here, and then they don't matter where it's much more logical that they should matter.
That's why it's super topsy-turvy, and that's why I think TikTok is an example of where they're, I don't understand. Do they know for a fact that China is controlling this social
media
platform?
Well, I mean, what we do know is that the Chinese, you know.
Because they control, let me tell you, they control a lot of things in America. Are we going to start banning everything? Like anything that comes from China, are we going to say no to that?
I mean, that is a good point. I think what we do know is that there is a version of TikTok in China, and that version is very educational. Instructional videos on playing the violin and learning to do ballet and gymnastics and Chinese philosophy and so on. So they're trying to improve their own citizens. But they are promoting, it seems, like a kind of a cultural decadence in America. But look, it's not unique to TikTok, right? I mean, we see a lot of that. Part of that is the receptivity in our culture to a lot of this kind of nonsense. I mean, to some degree, these platforms share algorithms based upon what people are watching.
Yeah,
and TikTok is no different in that regard.
True.
Let's switch topics. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, made a very remarkable speech in which he said that there are obstacles to peace in Israel. And one of the main ones, he said, is Netanyahu. So he said the Israelis need to have elections promptly because we cannot have people in office who don't respect the two-state solution. So the starting point is that the solution is a two-state solution, meaning an Israeli state, a Jewish state, and a Palestinian state. That alone, to me, raises big questions. Who exactly is going to be in the other state? Who's going to be the leadership of this other state? Is it the Palestinian Authority, the old, the old PLO? Is it going to be Hamas? Is it going to be whom the Palestinians elect? The last time they elected, it was Hamas.
Yeah, or worse yet, Iran.
Manipulated from the outside. Yeah. Very likely outcome because Iran is a heavy supporter of both Hamas and Hezbollah.
More so Hezbollah. So yeah.
Now McConnell, to his credit, and he doesn't deserve a lot of credit these days, but he had a very savage response, and a lot of prominent Israeli leaders. Benny Gantz, who's perhaps the main opposition leader, Naftali Bennett, who was the former prime minister, all of them in a pretty unified way huddle around Bibi, huddle around Netanyahu, and they all go, listen, you know, Chuck Schumer, you're supposed to be a friend of Israel. You know, Chuck Schumer goes around boasting he's the highest ranked elected Jew in America, right? And they're saying, look, you might be that and you might be the friend of Israel you claim to be, but you really can't go around telling a sovereign democratic society that it's got to have elections. It's got to elect a guy who wants a two-state solution. So the Israelis are, I think, pretty unified in telling Schumer to back off.
Well, you know, ideologically, though, it's really interesting. As you know, I get that Haaretz.
Very left-wing
Jewish publication.
Out of Israel.
And it's literally, they absolutely hate Netanyahu. And everything is about how he's like ruining Israel and how he is the cause of all the hostages still being in Gaza, and on and on and on it goes. So it's not surprising that Schumer would take their side, because the left wing coalition down in Israel has that same sentiment. And so do they really understand what they're doing as far as like trying to appease a terrorist organization like Hamas? Because Hamas is in charge, let's face it. And so what they're doing really is they're condoning what Hamas did, and they're making Netanyahu the problem. No, the problem is not Netanyahu. The problem is Hamas. The problem is all of the neighbors of Israel want to have Israel gone and destroyed. That is the problem. It's not Netanyahu.
You know, ironically, to me, a big problem is not only the United States, but the sentiment in Israel that by insisting that the recovery of the hostages is primary, this is actually what is stopping the decimation of Hamas, right? Because think about all these tunnels, all these Hamas tunnels. The Israelis could blow them up. You find a tunnel, you put explosives at both ends, boom,
right,
and that's it. But right. They could be hostages in the tunnels.
Yep, I know.
So because of that, you're like, I can't blow up the tunnels. Yeah. And so the operation has to move at a glacial pace. And it's always about, can we get... And Hamas knows. I think this is why they took hostages in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
They realize if we take hostages, we will have a
upper hand.
Right. And there is a certain type of moral compunction in the West shared by Israel that the lives of these hostages is of infinite worth.
Yeah.
And therefore... Now, think about it. If you did this to the Romans, the ancient Romans, they would be like, kill all the hostages right now. Because But if you do, then no stone will be left on top of another stone anywhere in Gaza.
Yeah.
So you're welcome to do what you can, but then wait and see what we will do to you in the aftermath of that. So if you give us the hostages back now, we might spare you.
Yeah.
We might. The key word is might, not will.
What about, and I'm definitely not a military strategist. I've never been in the military. I don't know. But what if, because right now they're saying, release all these prisoners, right? Even hardened prisoners from your prisons. And we're going to give you women and children and the ill and all of that back. What if you make a deal with them and say, no, you give us all the hostages, we'll give you all the prisoners, right? They do that. They do the exchange. We have all the hostages. And then, boom, you just blow up all of Gaza, you know?
This is
so you blow up all the prisoners and all of Hamas and all of the... Why not?
I think that's a clever idea, but I don't think it would work because Hamas is not that dumb. Hamas would not agree to do that in a manner.
Yeah.
A better way, I think, is very simple and very straightforward, and that is basically that you can give us the hostages back or you can keep them.
Yeah.
It's up to you, but our response to you is not going to be determined by any of that. We're going to move full speed ahead, and if you return the hostages, we might consider sparing some of you.
Yeah, this
but
is a story.
Not, we won't.
This is a story that's not going to go away anytime soon. And by the way, we are going to Israel in a couple of months, so to do some filming. So that's going to be interesting to see. And also, just know that Israel is surrounded by enemies, and you know, God bless them because they need God's protection.
For sure. I'm continuing my discussion of Lincoln's Lyceum speech. We're discussing Harry Jaffa's book, Crisis of the House Divided. Now, I took a few days off in discussing the Lincoln book and the Lincoln speeches. Partly, I had Zev Ornstein in the studio for most of a full show, and then I was traveling this week to give a talk in Naples, so I decided to take a short break and then pick it up today. Now, Lincoln makes a point about the difference between founding a republic and continuing or maintaining it. Now, what is the difference between those two things? The first is that the founder is sort of never part of the republic that he founds. The founder creates something new, but the something new is of a different order than what came before. Think, for example, about Moses. Moses, in a sense, creates a new society in the Promised Land, But the Bible doesn't hesitate to point out that Moses actually never himself got to the promised land. He was the founder, and yet the successors and descendants of Moses lived in a very different society and environment than Moses himself did. Moreover, while Moses was motivated by the oppression in Egypt, the all the sins inflicted upon the Jews by the Pharaohs, on the Israelites by the Pharaohs, it was that hatred of Egypt that led to independence. But once the Israelites are in their own land, you can't worry too much about the Pharaohs. They're far away. And you can't perpetuate your society just by having hatred of Egypt. Now you have to have love of Israel. You have to have a kind of a positive affection for your own society. And that's, again, a different motivation than Moses had. Why? Because the new society didn't yet exist. The other thing about a founder is that a founder is creating a new society, but is always aware of all the alternatives that exist before the new society is created. And so, for example, think of the people who started the French Revolution. Their slogan was liberty, equality, fraternity. But maybe they considered other slogans. Maybe they considered liberty and justice. Maybe they considered fraternity and benevolence. So for the founders, the people launching the revolution, they had a menu of ideas to choose from. Now, once they've created a new society, then everyone who comes subsequently lives under this new society, and they take those ideas for granted. So, for example, we're born into American society. We already have a constitution. It never occurs to us, well, what if we had a different constitution? What if we had a constitution that didn't have a Bill of Rights at all? Or instead of having an original 10 amendments, which were the 10 rights, we had 100. In other words, these things don't occur to us because what is passed down to us is a certain type of society structured in a certain type of a way. Now, says Lincoln, where does the danger to our society come from? A danger different from the one the founders faced, because the danger the founders faced was Great Britain. It was a foreign colonial power. But says Lincoln, what are the dangers Americans face once the founding is over? What is the danger of maintaining a republic? And he goes on to argue that the main danger comes from a mob rule, but mob rule that is provoked and led by a certain type of Caesar, by a certain Caesarian type of person. So not necessarily a restoration of the old monarchy. Lincoln doesn't really worry about that. But a leader that emerges inside of a democratic society that has the qualities of a Julius Caesar. Now, let's ask what those qualities are, because we're so used to Julius Caesar, Shakespeare, Brutus and Cassius. And in some ways, you can even read that play without being clear, what is it that's so bad about Caesar? They kept talking about Caesar will be a tyrant, but he never has a chance to be a tyrant. And before that, he is killed. So what is the Caesarian danger? For Lincoln, the Caesarian danger is a demagogue of a leader that allies himself with the mob. The mob here meaning the vast mass of people. And what he does is he encourages the mob to go with its basest appetite. So the mob says, for example, let's go ahead and lynch this black guy. And then the demagogue goes, yeah, let's do it. Or the mob goes, you know, it'd be great to have slavery. What's better than getting people to work for us for free? And then the demagogue of a leader goes, yeah, that's a great idea. Choose that option. There's nothing wrong in choosing slavery. So the point that Lincoln here is getting at is that a democratic society, in order to work, requires a lot of moral restraint. Now, think about today how little we hear about this idea of moral restraint. Which of our leaders today is calling us to moral restraint? And yet, why do we need it? What is Lincoln's case for why moral restraint is essential for a constitutional republic? Well, Lincoln's answer is this, and that is that if you want your rights to be respected in a society, you've got to learn to respect the rights of others. And therefore, You cannot simply be guided by your passions and simply say, I want this, therefore it's mine. I want this, therefore it's entitled. I'm entitled to it. No, the real question is that you're existing in a society, you're free and you're equal, and you can demand equality for yourself, but you have to also recognize that other people have those same rights, and they too can demand equality, an equivalent equality that you have to consider and respect. So Lincoln's point is this: the danger that is posed by Douglas and Douglas's kind of gospel of popular sovereignty is that it represents a new type of Caesarism. And by Caesarism, what Lincoln here means is a demagogic leader that is promising people something that they're not entitled to. Let's think about how this applies to Douglas. What is Douglas saying? Douglas is basically saying that if a community or a society wants to have slavery, then they should. If they don't want to, then they shouldn't. But let's consider the idea, the first possibility. This is a society that decides we want to have slavery. Lincoln's point is, if you want to have slavery, you want something that you are not really entitled to. Why? Because you're a human being, so is the slave. You are free and equal, so should the slave have the right to the same freedom and equality. You work for your labor and you demand to be paid for it. Why shouldn't the slave be compensated for his labor? And Lincoln will go on later to meet all kinds of objections to this. Well, what if the slave is inferior? What if the slave is not as smart? What if the slave is naturally oriented to menial work? And Lincoln's answers here are very, very powerful and very simple and very clear. He doesn't get into a big debate. No, the slave is not inferior. No, the slave is just as well educated. No, the slave has the same capacity. Lincoln doesn't go there. Lincoln basically says, if God hath given him little, that little let him enjoy. In other words, if this guy is inferior, like you say, if his work is only entitled to $1 an hour and yours is $10 an hour, he should still be entitled to the $1. Let him bargain for the wage that he's allowed and that he can bargain for, and let him keep it. He has the right to the fruits of his own labor. So you see here the sort of just simplicity, the moral simplicity of Lincoln's argument. And what Lincoln is getting at here is that self-governing people need to impose chains. And I'm using this phrase deliberately because slavery is about imposing chains. But Lincoln's point is we need to impose some chains on our own appetites. And then you go, well, what does this mean, Dinesh? Are you saying that people should enslave themselves? And the point here is no. If you impose a chain on your own appetites, you're not enslaving yourself. Slavery is only when this imposition is done without consent. So if you go put chains on somebody else and they go, no, 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 I don't want to be chained. And you go, yes, you're going to be chained because I've got to drag you from Africa to work for me for free. That is slavery. On the other hand, if you say, I have all these appetites, I want to enslave people, I want to get them to work for me for free, and you realize, you know what, that's actually not right. We can't do that. That undercuts the very principle of a free society. So what Lincoln is doing here, in the Lyceum speech, he doesn't really mention slavery at all. He's just talking about mob rule. He's talking about the emergence of a leader who thinks that he's above the law, this sort of Caesar type. And Lincoln gives the specific examples of a Caesar and a Napoleon. And I think Lincoln is arguing that the combination of this type of a Caesar type of leader, along with a mob that begins to lose respect for law and believes we can do anything that we want because the people demand it. The people are behind it. Our appetites are pointing us in this direction. And Lincoln's point is that is the ruination of a free society. And in fact, the type of leader we should be looking for is a different type of leader. I'll talk about this next week. A leader that does not encourage the mob to indulge its appetites, but a leader who calls for a certain type of moral restraint, where in demanding our own rights, and rightfully so, we also respect the rights of others.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.